Well, good morning, brothers, sisters, young people, and friends of God's truth. It's so good to be with you all this weekend. Sister Judy and myself have been looking forward to the gathering. And I just want to, seeing as how this is the last event that we're having at the Bible school this year, I just want to thank the Bible school committee and all of the brothers and sisters that help to make this a successful gathering or Bible school this year. Our thanks to you. As far as Judy and myself are concerned, you're all like our family. And so we're really glad to be here this weekend. So our classes this morning are going to focus on events that have shown that God is in control of events that take place in this world, and that the promises He made to the patriarchal fathers have a realistic position of why Israel survives today. And the title of our classes this morning is Against All Odds, Israel Survives. Well, in our first class this morning, we want to consider, the first thing that we want to consider is the account in the book of Judges in chapters 6 through 8, and we're going to look at some examples this morning from the Old Testament of what appears to be miraculous results in overcoming significant odds. When we look at the book of Judges, chapter 6 through chapter 8, it deals with the Midianites oppressing Israel and Gideon's call to service. And you can remember from the Arkansas Bible School, our brother John Manson gave an exhortation, and he started out with Gideon, the story of Gideon. But we're going to look at that a little more in depth this morning. And we find that Gideon was the son of Joash of the family of Abiezer, as we read in Judges 6:11, from the tribe of Manasseh, who lived in Ophrah and delivered Israel from Midian. He's also called Jerubbaal, and he judged Israel 40 years as the fifth judge. So let's open our Bibles to Judges chapter 6. We'll just keep our finger in Judges for a while. We read in Judges chapter 6, verse 1, "And the children of Israel did evil in the sight of Yahweh, and Yahweh delivered them into the hand of Midian 7 years. Well, it is at the close of these 7 years of intimidation and oppression that we find Gideon, the son of Joash, hiding his precious wheat from the eastern invaders. Continuing in chapter 6, we read, beginning with verse 2, "And the hand of Midian prevailed against Israel, and because of the Midianites, the children of Israel made them the dens which are in the mountains, and caves, and strongholds. And so it was when Israel had sown, or that is, planted crops, that the Midianites came up, and the Amalekites, and the children of the east, even they came up against them, and they encamped against them, and destroyed the increase of the earth, till they come unto Gaza, and left no substance for Israel, neither sheep, nor ox, nor ass. For they came up with their cattle and their tents, and they came as grasshoppers for multitude. For both they and their camels were without number, and they entered into the land to destroy it. And Israel was greatly impoverished because of the Midianites. And the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh. And it came to pass, when the children of Israel cried unto Yahweh because of the Midianites, that Yahweh sent a prophet unto the children of Israel, which said unto them, Thus saith the Lord God of Israel, I brought you up from Egypt, and brought you forth out of the house of bondage, and I delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians, and out of the hand of all that oppressed you, and drave them out from before you, and gave you their land. And I said unto you, I am Yahweh your God. Fear not the gods of the Amorites, in whose land ye dwell, but ye have not obeyed my voice." While Gideon's call is presented in a series of events, we first see him threshing wheat by the winepress to hide it from the Midianites in Judges chapter 6, verse 11. Then picking up with verse 12 and continuing to verse 16, we read, "And the angel of Yahweh appeared unto him and said unto him, Yahweh is with thee, thou mighty man of valor. And Gideon said unto him, O my Lord, if Yahweh be with us, then why is all this befallen us? And where be all his miracles which our fathers told us of, saying, Did not Yahweh bring us up from Egypt? But now Yahweh hath forsaken us, and delivered us into the hands of the Midianites. And Yahweh looked upon him and said, Go in this thy might, and thou shalt save Israel from the hand of the Midianites. Have not I sent thee? And he said unto him, O my Lord, wherewith shall I save Israel? Behold, my family is poor in Manasseh, and I am the least of my father's house. And Yahweh said unto him, Surely I will be with thee, and thou shalt smite the Midianites as one man." Well, history teaches us that obscurity of birth is no obstacle to noble service. It was no dishonor for Gideon to say, "My family is poor," or that he was from the small family of an unprestigious tribe. Continuing with verse 17 in chapter 6, "And he, Gideon, said unto him, If now I have found grace in thy sight, then show me a sign that thou talkest with me." Well, we read in verse 20 to 23 of chapter 6, "And the angel of God said unto him, Take the flesh and the unleavened cakes, and lay them upon this rock, and pour out the broth. And he did so. Then the angel of Yahweh put forth the end of the staff that was in his hand, and touched the flesh and the unleavened cakes. And there rose up a fire out of the rock, and consumed the flesh and the unleavened cakes. Then the angel of Yahweh departed out of his sight. And when Gideon perceived that he was an angel of Yahweh, Gideon said, Alas, O Lord God, for because I have seen an angel of Yahweh face to face, and Yahweh said unto him, Peace be unto thee, fear not, thou shalt not die." Well, before Gideon could lead the nation, however, Yahweh called upon him to be a leader, to be a leader in his own family. At night, Gideon and 10 of his servants destroyed the altar which his father Joash used to worship the Canaanite god named Baal. No wonder they called him Jerubbaal, meaning discomforter of Baal. When Joash saw that his son remained unharmed after this bold act, he became Gideon's defender. He argued with those who wanted to kill Gideon that if Baal was truly a god, he would be able to avenge himself. Reading from Judges chapter 6, verse 32. "Therefore on that day he, Joash, called him Jerubbaal, saying, Let Baal plead against him, because he hath thrown down his altar." Well, it may have been merely fear of reprisal that kept Joash from doing what his son had done for him. Now Yahweh was patient with Gideon's doubts and convinced him with one sign after another that he was the man to lead Israel in battle. In Judges chapter 6, verse 33, "Then all the Midianites and the Amalekites and the children of the east were gathered together and went over and pitched in the valley of Jezreel." Now facing the great mission of his life, Gideon had to have an assuring token that God was with him. And most of us are familiar with Gideon and the fleece. We read in Judges chapter 6, verses 36 to 40, "And Gideon said unto God, If thou wilt save Israel by mine hand, as thou hast said, behold, I will put a fleece of wool on the floor, and if the dew be on the fleece only, and it be dry upon all the earth beside, then shall I know that thou wilt save Israel by my hand, as thou hast said. And it was so, for he rose up early on the morrow, and thrust the fleece together, wrung out the dew of the fleece, a bowl full of water. And Gideon said unto God, Let not thine anger be hot against me, and I will speak but this once. Let me prove, I pray thee, but this once with the fleece. Let it now be dry only upon the fleece and upon all the ground let there be dew. And God did so that night, for it was dry upon the fleece only, and there was dew on all the ground. Well, the news of Gideon's victory over Baal spread quickly, and when Gideon blew his trumpet, 32,000 volunteered to fight against their enemy of 135,000 men. Yahweh's plan, though, did not require 32,000 men. In accordance with Mosaic law, Gideon allowed the fearful and the faint-hearted to return home. And we can compare that to Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 8. We're not going to look up some of these references due to the time's sake. Well, Yahweh now needed to separate the foolhardy, who had feared neither man nor God, from the faithful, who would obey the very strange tactics that were to be given. Sending the men down to some water near enemy lines, Gideon kept only 300 who drank with their heads erect so that they could see what was going on. These men were neither foolhardy nor presumptuous. They were courageous but also cautious. They were alert men who proved to be obedient as well. How fascinating is the incident of the reduction of Gideon's army from 32,000 to 10,000, and then only to 300. 300 men against the countless swarms of Midian. Yes, but these few choice, brave, active men, even though their numbers showed that they were in the minority, God had their side fighting for them. And God was on their side. And God is not always on the side of big battalions or numbers. And we know this because of what he says in Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 7 to 10. This we want to look up. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 7 to 10. This is what he says about the nation of Israel. Yahweh did not set his love upon you, nor choose you, because you were more in number than any people. For you were the fewest of all people. But because Yahweh loved you, and because he would keep the oath which he had sworn unto your fathers, hath Yahweh brought you out with a mighty hand, and redeemed you out of the house of bondmen from the hand of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. Know therefore that Yahweh, thy God, he is God, the faithful God, which keepeth covenant and mercy with them that love him, and keep his commandments to 1,000 generations, and repayeth them that hate him to their face, to destroy them. He will not be slack to him that hateth him. He will repay him to his face. Well, the battle that began at midnight became a rout. Gideon's band of 300 men executed their instructions perfectly. We read in Judges chapter 7, verses 20 to 22. Judges chapter 7. Verses 20 to 22. And the three companies blew the trumpets and brake the pitchers and held the lamps in their left hands and the trumpets in their right hands to blow withal. And they cried, "The sword of Yahweh and of Gideon!" And they stood, every man in his place, round about the camp. And all the host ran and cried and fled. And the 300 blew the trumpets, and the Lord set every man's sword against his fellow, even throughout all the host. And the host fled to Bethsheba in Zererath and to the border of Abel-Meholah unto Tabith. Not one of Gideon's men were killed. For as they chased the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb, we read in Judges chapter 8, verse 4. That's Judges chapter 8, verse 4. And Gideon came to Jordan and passed over, he and the 300 men, the 300 men that were with him, faint yet pursuing them. Well, even hours after exhaustive pursuit, Gideon and his men in their faint condition overcame and conquered 15,000 enemies, as we see in Judges chapter 8, verses 10 to 12. Judges chapter 8, verses 10 to 12. Now Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor, and their host with them, about 15,000 men, all that were left of the host of the children of the east. For there fell 120,000 men that drew sword. And Gideon went up by the way of them that dwelt in tents on the east of Nobah and Jogbehah, and smote the host, for the host was secure. And when Zeba and Zalmunna fled, he pursued after them and took the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and discomfited all the host. Well, Gideon is found in the roll call of faith. And it's no small honor to have a place in Hebrews chapter 11, where every name is an inspiration and every person is listed as a miracle of grace. We read in Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 34. That's Hebrews chapter 11, verses 32 to 34. And what shall I more say? For the time would fail to tell me of Gideon and of Barak and of Samson and of Jephthah and David also and Samuel and of the prophets who through faith subdued kingdoms, wrought righteousness, obtained promises, stopped the mouths of lions, quenched the violence of fire, escaped the edge of the sword, out of weakness were made strong, waxed valiant in flight, turned to flight the armies of the aliens. Well, however, this is not the end of this great victory against all odds. Gideon became a hero overnight. The Israelites offered him the first hereditary crown. The first hereditary crown. They said, "Rule over us, both thou and thy son, and thy son's son also, for thou hast delivered us from the hand of Midian." That's in Judges 8, verse 22. And what happened? Well, Gideon refused, but their offer prompted him to make what seemed to be a modest request. He asked that all the soldiers, which included the thousands who had later joined the original 300, give him the golden earrings that they had spoiled from their enemy. Now, the total amount of gold collected was 1,700 shekels, or about 42 pounds. At $1,200 per ounce, this would be equivalent today to about $806,400. At 1,300, that's when I wrote this class, it was 1,200 per ounce. Now gold is at around $1,350 per ounce. So that's the equivalent of $907,250, which is close to $1,000,000. Judges chapter 8, verse 27 reads, "And Gideon made an ephod thereof, and put it in his city, even in Ophrah. And all Israel went thither a whoring after it, which thing became a snare unto Gideon and to his house." So when you think about this and what took place, a question arises, why did Gideon refuse the crown? Well, Gideon's explanation is found in Judges chapter 8, verse 23, where he says, "And Gideon said unto them, I will not rule over you, neither shall my son rule over you, Yahweh shall rule over you." Well, Gideon was convinced that the unique method of government which Yahweh had established for Israel was more effective than a hereditary monarchy. Yahweh had designated one particular tribe to judge issues of a local nature. The tribe of Levi was to be especially familiar with the Mosaic law, as we see in Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 9. That's Deuteronomy chapter 17, verse 9. "And thou shalt come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall show thee the sentence of judgment." Well, for issues on a national level, especially war, Yahweh would appoint an individual at large in whom was the Spirit to lead the nation, as we see in Numbers chapter 27, verses 18 to 20. That's Numbers chapter 27, verses 18 to 20. "And Yahweh said unto Moses, Take thee Joshua, the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay thine hand upon him, and set him before Eleazar the priest, and before all the congregation, and give him a charge in their sight. And thou shalt put some of thine honor upon him, that all the congregation of the children of Israel may be obedient." Well, Gideon had just demonstrated the effectiveness of this method during a national crisis. 300 men under Yahweh's leadership had routed 135,000 Midianites. Gideon believed that God's plan of leadership, his rule over the nation, was superior to a kingship. And it still is. It still is. The next account that we want to consider against all odds is found in 1 Samuel chapter 14. And here we have Israel's King Saul and his son Jonathan with about 600 men abiding in Gibeah of Benjamin. But the Philistines encamped in Michmash. Backing up to chapter 13, verse 9. 1 Samuel chapter 13, verse 19. Verse 19 we read, "Now there was no smith found throughout all the land of Israel. For the Philistines said, lest the Hebrews make them swords or spears." Then in verse 22 and 23 of that 13th chapter we read, "So it came to pass in the day of battle that there was neither sword nor spear found in the hand of any of the people that were with Saul and with Jonathan. But with Saul and with Jonathan his son was there found. And the garrison of the Philistines went out to the passage of Michmash." Michmash. Continuing with verse 1 of chapter 14, "Now it came to pass upon a day that Jonathan, the son of Saul, said unto the young man that bare his armor, Come, and let us go over to the Philistines' garrison that is on the other side. But he told not his father." Then skipping down to verse 4 and reading through verse 23. That's verse 4, and we're going to read through verse 23. "And between the passages by which Jonathan sought to go over unto the Philistines' garrison, there was a sharp rock on the one side, and a sharp rock on the other side. And the name of one was Bozez, and the name of the other, Sinna. The forefront of one was situate northward over against Michmash, and the other southward over against Gibeah. And Jonathan said to the young man that bare his armor, Come, and let us go over unto the garrison of these uncircumcised. It may be that the Lord will work for us. For there is no restraint to Yahweh, to save by many or by few." I want to repeat that. "For there is no restraint to Yahweh to save by many or by few. And his armor bearer said unto him, Do all that is in thine heart. Turn thee, behold, I am with thee according to thy heart. Then said Jonathan, Behold, we will pass over unto these men, and we will discover ourselves unto them. If they say thus unto us, Tarry until we come to you, then we will stand still in our place and will not go up unto them. But if they say thus, Come up unto us, then we will go up, for the Lord hath delivered them into our hand, and this shall be a sign unto us. And both of them discovered themselves unto the garrison of the Philistines. And the Philistines said, Behold, the Hebrews come forth out of the holes where they have hid themselves. And the men of the garrison answered Jonathan and the armor-bearer and said, Come up to us, and we will show you a thing. And Jonathan said to his armor-bearer, Come up after me, for the Lord hath delivered them into the hand of Israel. And Jonathan climbed up upon his hands and upon his feet, and his armor-bearer after him. And there fell before Jonathan and his armor-bearer, they slew after him. And that first slaughter which Jonathan and his armor-bearer made was about 20 men, within, as it were, an half acre of land, which a yoke of oxen might plow. And there was trembling in the host, and in the field, and among all the people, the garrison and the spoilers, they also trembled, and the earth quaked, so it was a very great trembling. And the watchmen of Saul and Gibeah of Benjamin looked, and behold, the multitude melted away, and they went on beating down one another. Then said Saul unto the people that were with him, number now and see who is gone from us. And when they had numbered, behold, Jonathan and his armor bearer were not there. And Saul said unto Ahiah, bring hither the ark of God. For the ark of God was at that time with the children of Israel. And it came to pass, while Saul talked unto the priest, that the noise that was in the host of the Philistines went on and increased. And Saul said unto the priest, withdraw thine hand. And Saul and all the people that were with him assembled themselves, and they came to the battle. And behold, every man's sword was against his fellow, and there was a very great discomfiture. Moreover, the Hebrews that were with the Philistines before that time, which went up with them into the camp from the country round about, even they also turned to be with the Israelites that were with Saul and Jonathan. Likewise, all the men of Israel, which had hid themselves in Mount Ephraim, when they heard that the Philistines fled, even they also followed hard after them in the battle. So the Lord saved Israel that day, and the battle passed over unto Bethaven. Well, the last event that we want to consider in this first class is found in 2 Kings chapter 18 and 19. Now, these chapters deal with Hezekiah, King Hezekiah, and the invasion of Judah by Sennacherib, king of Assyria. Hezekiah faced three crises in a short time: the invasion of the Assyrian army, sickness and near death, and the visit of the Babylonian envoys. Now, we know from Scripture that he was victorious in the first two tests, but he stumbled in the matter of the Babylonian envoys. When we consider this matter of the Babylonian envoys, where the pride of life overcame Hezekiah and he showed him all the treasures that he had in his house, we would do well to examine our lives to see how successfully or unsuccessfully we have handled our own tests. We all have frailties of human flesh, and we are all subject to temptations. Hezekiah had led the nation in a great reformation, and the people were reunited in his kingship in the fear of Yahweh. They had put away their idols. They had restored the temple service, and they had sought the blessing of their God. But instead of receiving a blessing, they found themselves facing battles. They were facing battles. We read the following in 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verses 1 to 8. 2 Chronicles chapter 32, verses 1 to 8. After these things and the establishment thereof, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came and entered into Judah and encamped against the fenced cities and thought to win them for himself. And when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib was come, and that he was purposed to fight against Jerusalem, he took counsel with his princes and his mighty men to stop the waters of the fountains, which were without the city, and they did help him. So there was gathered much people together who stopped all the fountains and the brook that ran through the midst of the land, saying, why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? Also he strengthened himself and built up all the wall that was broken, and raised it up to the towers, and another wall without, and repaired Millo in the city of David, and made darts and shields in abundance. And he set captains of war over the people, and he gathered them together to him in the street of the gate of the city, and he spake comfortably to them, saying, be strong and courageous. Be not afraid nor dismayed for the king of Assyria, nor for all the multitude that is with him. For there be more with us than with him. With him is the arm of flesh, but with us is the Lord our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people rested themselves upon the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. While the Assyrian invasion was a part of God's discipline to teach His people to trust Him alone, to trust Him alone, Hezekiah had at first put his trust in treaties and treasures, only to learn that the enemy will keep the wealth, but will not keep his word. We see this from 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 13 to 16. 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 13 to 16. Now in the 14th year of King Hezekiah, did Sennacherib, king of Assyria, come up against all the fenced cities of Judah and took them. And Hezekiah, king of Judah, sent to the king of Assyria, to Lachish, saying, I have offended. Return from me. That which thou puttest on me will I bear. And the king of Assyria appointed unto Hezekiah, king of Judah, 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold. And Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was found in the house of Yahweh and in the treasures of the king's house. At that time did Hezekiah cut off the gold from the doors of the temple of Yahweh and from the pillars which Hezekiah, king of Judah, had overlaid and gave it to the king of Assyria. Well, Judah also had negotiated to get help from Egypt, an act of unbelief that Isaiah severely rebuked in Isaiah chapter 30, verses 1 to 7, and Isaiah chapter 31, verses 1 to 3. And again, we're not going to look those verses up. Reading just, though, from Isaiah 31, verses 1 to 3, we read, Woe to them that go down to Egypt for help, and stay on horses, and trust in chariots, because they are many, and in horsemen, because they are very strong. But they look not unto the Holy One of Israel, neither seek Yahweh. Yet He also is wise and will bring evil, and will not call back His words, but will arise against the house of the evildoers, and against the help of them that work iniquity. Now the Egyptians are men and not God, and their horses flesh and not spirit. When Yahweh shall stretch out His hand, both he that helpeth shall fall, and he that is hoping shall fall down, and they all shall fall or fail together. God's great purpose in life of faith is to build godly character. Hezekiah and his people needed to learn that. Now the Assyrians had ravaged Judah, and we're now at Lachish, about 30 miles southwest of Jerusalem. According to 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 17 to 18. 2 Kings chapter 18, verses 17 to 18. And the king of Assyria sent Tartan. Now Tartan is a title meaning supreme commander, or commander-in-chief. And Rapsaris means chief officer. And Rabshakeh means field commander or chief of staff from Lachish to King Hezekiah with a great host against Jerusalem. And they went up and came to Jerusalem. And when they were come up, they came and stood by the conduit of the upper pool, which is in the highway of the fuller's field. And when they had called to the king, there came out to them Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, which was over the household, and Shebna, the scribe, and Joah, the son of Asaph, the recorder. Well, the place of their meeting is significant. The place of their meeting is significant, for it's the very place where Isaiah confronted Ahaz, who was Hezekiah's father some 30 years before, as we read in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3. That's Isaiah chapter 7, verse 3. Then said the Lord unto Isaiah, Go forth now to meet Ahaz, thou and Shear-Jashub thy son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool in the highway of the fuller's field. Ahaz has refused to trust Yahweh, but had instead made a treaty with Assyria, We find that in 2 Kings chapter 16, verses 5 to 9. We're not looking that up. And now the Assyrians were ready to take Jerusalem. Isaiah had warned Ahaz what Assyria would do in Isaiah chapter 7, verse 17 to 25, and his words were now fulfilled. The field commander, that's Rabshakeh, speech is one of the most blasphemous found anywhere in Scripture. For he reproached the God of Israel in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 4, 17, and 23 to 24. He emphasized the greatness of the king of Assyria in Isaiah chapter 36, verse 13, because he knew the common people were listening with the fighters that were up on the wall, and he wanted to frighten them. He wanted to frighten them, as we read in Isaiah chapter 37, verses 1 to 12. His speech was psychological warfare, in which he discredited everything that the Jews held dear. The key word that he used in his talk was the word trust, and he used it 7 times in Isaiah chapter 36, beginning at verse 4. And Rabshakeh said unto them, "Say ye now to Hezekiah, thus saith the great king, the king of Assyria, what confidence is this wherein thou trustest? I say thou, but they are but vain words. I have counsel and strength for war. Now on whom dost thou trust, that thou rebellest against me? Lo, thou trustest in the staff of this broken reed, on Egypt, whereon if a man lean, it will go into his hand and pierce it. So is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all that trust in him. But if thou say to me, we trust in the Lord our God, well, is it not he whose high places and whose altars Hezekiah hath taken away and said to Judah and to Jerusalem, ye shall worship before this altar? Well, then skipping down to verse 9, how then wilt thou turn away the face of one captain of the least of my master's servants and put thy trust on Egypt for chariots and for horsemen? Then verse 15, neither let Hezekiah make you trust in the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely deliver us. This city shall not be delivered into the hand of the king of Assyria. Well, just remember what Proverbs chapter 3, verse 5 says. Trust in Yahweh with all thine heart, and lean not unto thine own understanding. According to Rabshakeh, Judah had no help on earth, Egypt, or in heaven, Yahweh. They were already defeated. His coup de grace was that everything Assyria had done was according to the will of the Lord. Isaiah chapter 36, verse 10, where he says, and am I now come up without the Lord against this land to destroy it? The Lord said unto me, go up into this land and destroy it. Well, how could Judah fight against its own God? Well, in one sense, this statement was true. For God is in charge of the nations of the world, as we read in Daniel chapter 4, verse 17, verse 25, verse 32, and Daniel chapter 5, verse 21. But no nation can do what it pleases and use God for the excuse, as Sennacherib and his army would soon find out. According to Rabshakeh, Judah could not trust in its strategy, in its military resources, or in its God. Nor could its people trust in their king, as we read in Isaiah chapter 36, verses 13 to 16. Hezekiah and Isaiah had told the people to trust Yahweh. But Rabshakeh reminded the people that the gods of the other nations had not been successful in protecting or delivering them. And Hezekiah knew why. And we can see this if we read Isaiah chapter 37, verses 18 to 19. Again, we're not going to read that due to time constraints. Even Samaria was defeated, and they worshiped the same God as Judah. For Rabshakeh, Yahweh was just another God, and Sennacherib did not need to worry about him. However, God had promised to deliver his people from the Assyrian army, and his word would stand. His word would stand. Hezekiah and his officers humbled themselves before Yahweh and sought his face. When Solomon had dedicated the temple, God had stated in 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. That's 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 14. If my people, which are called by my name, shall humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven and will forgive their sin and will heal their land. While Yahweh had brought Assyria to chasten Judah, as we see in Isaiah chapter 7, verses 17 to 25, he had determined that Jerusalem would not be taken by the enemy. Previous to the invasion, when Hezekiah had been deathly ill, Isaiah had assured him of deliverance. And we read this in Isaiah chapter 38, verses 4 to 6. God's promises are sure. God's promises are sure. And in the building up of our faith, the Word of God and prayer go together. That is why one of my favorite Bible verses, and I've stated this before, one of my favorite Bible verses is Romans chapter 10, verse 17, which says, "So then faith cometh by hearing, and hearing by the Word of God." Isaiah sent the king a message from the Lord, and it had 3 points. The first point was, do not be afraid. The second point was, the Assyrians will depart. And the third point was, the great king will die in Assyria. Well, when the 3 Assyrian officers returned to Sennacherib, they learned that an Egyptian army was on its way to help defend Hezekiah. Sennacherib did not want to fight a war on 2 fronts, so he put pressure on Jerusalem to surrender immediately. What did he do? Well, a threatening message was sent to Hezekiah in a letter. He sent a message in a letter, and Hezekiah took the letter to the temple, and he spread it before Yahweh. Hezekiah then offered a prayer, and it's found in Isaiah chapter 37, verses 15 to 20. We're not going to look at that, but this is a beautiful prayer. It's a beautiful prayer. God's response to this prayer was found in Isaiah chapter 37, verse 21 to 35, and it was to send King Hezekiah another threefold message of assurance. Jerusalem would not be taken, verses 31 to 35. The Assyrians would depart, which is in verse 29, and the Jews would not starve, which is in verse 30. Well, God defended Jerusalem for his name's sake, because Sennacherib had reproached the Holy One of Israel. The Assyrians had exalted themselves above Yahweh, the Holy One of Israel. God also saved Jerusalem because of his covenant that he had made with David. The covenant that he had made with David in Isaiah chapter 37, verses 35, and 2 Samuel chapter 7, verses 24 to 29. Jerusalem was the city of David, and God had promised that one day one of David's descendants would reign on the throne forever. And we know that this promise will ultimately be fulfilled when Jesus Christ returns to this earth and reigns as king. Turn to Isaiah chapter 37. Turn to Isaiah chapter 37. And we want to read verses 33 to 38. That's verses 33 to 38. Therefore, thus saith Yahweh concerning the king of Assyria, he shall not come in to this city, nor shoot an arrow there, nor come before it with shields, nor cast a bank against it. By the way that he came, by the same shall he return, and shall not come into this city, saith Yahweh. For I will defend this city to save it, for mine own sake, and for my servant David's sake. For my servant David's sake. Then the angel of Yahweh went forth and smote in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. That's 185,000. 185,000 were smote. And when they arose early in the morning, behold, they were all dead corpses. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went and returned and dwelt in Nineveh. And it came to pass, as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch, his god, that Adrammelech and Charezer, having trouble pronouncing this, so excuse that, Charezer, his son, smote him with the sword. And they escaped into the land of Armenia. And Esarhaddon, his son, reigned in his stead. So in this first class, we see that against all odds, Israel survived. Israel overcame enemies because of God's promises and help. We also know that for disobedience, Israel did not survive as a nation and was dispersed into Gentile nations after AD 70. Well, in the next two classes, we will see how against all odds, Israel will return to the land and against all odds be set up in a day as a nation. They'll survive wars, reinstitute the Hebrew language, and continue to be God's chosen people. Now I have a handout that I want to pass out. This is a timeline of events that took place in Jewish history. And in this timeline, we will be referring to some of the dates, and possibly some of these dates aren't correct, but they're what's there. But at the fourth page of this handout in our next class, in one of our next classes, you'll notice that there are On the last page, there are three websites. The first website is www.ZionismIsrael.com, Zionism Timeline, from where this handout came from. And then there's two other websites that we will be referring to in our next class. And so with that, we'll discontinue this class. Dismiss.